Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, November 13th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, 4th District Supervisor Natalie Arroyo announces re-election campaign, Daikin Clan Band returns to Humble on tour raising money for the Diné tribe in Arizona, and makers of arts and lovers of culture rejoice as the Ink people finally find a home after 46 years. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyone, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Humboldt County's current 4th District Supervisor, Natalie Arroyo, officially announced her re-election campaign to continue representing Eureka, Fairhaven, and Samoa. Gabriel Zucker reports.
Humboldt County's 4th District Supervisor, Natalie Arroyo, officially launched her re-election campaign to continue representing the 4th District, which encompasses Eureka, Fairhaven, and Samoa. Even though the primary election will take place on June 2nd, 2026, she wanted to announce her re-election bid early to let people know she is serious about her position.
I don't know if I'll have a challenger. I suspect I will at some point, but I'm getting in there early to let people know that I'm running again and that, you know, I really have the experience and the passion to keep on serving in this role. So I hope that folks will allow me to continue serving for them.
Looking back at her first term as district supervisor, Arroyo talked about all of the accomplishments Humboldt has made during her first term, highlighting the Humboldt Bay Trail and infrastructure improvements through Measure O.
The county has had some incredible accomplishments. We completed the Humboldt Bay Trail, which was a, you know, more than two decades in the making, connecting Arcata and Eureka, which is serving a lot of, you know, non-motorized users of different modes of transportation, from bikes and people walking to using wheelchairs. We've also secured funding for infrastructure improvements through Measure O, which will help us seek additional funds from the state so it can offer some match essentially locally to grant funding that we can pull in. So we're going to be seeing a lot of infrastructure improvements, and already are, as well as transit improvements as a result of that. So those are a few of the things that come to mind. You know, we've also passed the McKinleyville Town Center Ordinance, which I don't represent the community of McKinleyville, but it's an important part of the county that's really growing, and there's a lot of opportunity there for, you know, multimodal transportation, as well as, you know, development that combines housing and affordability with a more town center feel.
There are still a lot of things Arroyo wants to still accomplish that she was unable to fully complete in her first term.
You know, it's 3 years has gone by really fast. I have a lot of areas that I'd like to focus on. One of those is affordable housing. You know, we've made some progress with some pretty big land use decisions and planning decisions, but I'd like to see some of those through to completion. We do have a housing trust fund in place now with a small balance that we can use to help advance affordable housing projects. So, you know, getting some of those actually in the works is a big one for me. I think there's, you know, a lot to do around economic development at this point in time. We're at kind of a crossroads between, you know, industries that we're seeing a decline in and industries that are offering possibilities on the horizon. So I'd certainly like to focus a lot of energy there as well.
According to her website, arroyoforsupervisor.com, Arroyo moved to Humboldt in 2006 as an AmeriCorps National Service member. Since then, she has worked in natural resource restoration, planning, and management, including nonprofits and even as a university instructor. She served in the Eureka City Council between 2014 to 2022. Then in 2023, she began serving as a District 4 County Supervisor. Quote, as a supervisor, she serves on the following boards or commissions. Humboldt Transit Authority as a chairperson, Redwood Region Economic Development Commission, Behavioral Health Board, Redwood Coast Energy Authority, First Five Humboldt Commission, Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Commission, and the Samoa Peninsula Enhanced Infrastructure Finance District. As a public official, Natalie previously served on the board of the Humboldt Waste Management Authority and Keep Eureka Beautiful. Natalie is honored to serve on the board of directors of the Klamath River Renewal Corporation, the nonprofit organization responsible for the removal of four dams on the Klamath River to restore the health of the region's rivers and salmon. Natalie has also previously served as the board president of the Humboldt Trails Council and as a board member of the Salmon Restoration Federation. End quote. Since Arroyo arrived, she has made herself a big part of the Humboldt community, building relationships with government and private officials, trying to build a better Humboldt. She loves the community and architecture and has noticed the community as a whole is becoming more inclusive.
I have to say I'm a Eureka girl through and through. I moved to Humboldt in 2006. I did live in Petrolia for a while. I loved it out there, but it just wasn't feasible for me to make it as a, you know, young person in such a remote place. And I, you know, I didn't have a lot of money, and I certainly didn't own land. So, you know, it was easy for me to kind of find my place in town here in Eureka. I've lived here since then. So, you know, I will say it's a combination of the kind of close-knit community feel here, the fact that we have a little bit of everything, you know, in the Humboldt Bay, greater Humboldt Bay area. And I personally really love the Victorian architecture and just all the architectural beauty. And then, of course, the natural beauty here. I also, it doesn't hurt that we have so little traffic. And, you know, so there's lots of things to love about this place. I also noticed that, you know, we're becoming more inclusive and diverse as a community. And I really appreciate that as a Latina. I really enjoy, like, having a chance to connect with people who share similar background to me, for example. So there's lots to love about this place, and I look forward to, you know, continuing to work on, you know, some of our challenging issues, but also some of the joyful moments in our community.
To learn more about Natalie Arroyo and her campaign, visit her Instagram at Arroyo for Supervisor or her campaign website, arroyoforsupervisor.com. This is Gabriel Zucker, and you're listening to KMUD.
On November 16th, activist band Clan Dykin returns to Humboldt County on their Beauty Way Tour, raising money for the Native people of Big Mountain and Black Mesa, Arizona. The Beauty Way Tour is an annual tour that brings attention to the relocation of the Diné people from their ancestral homelands that is still ongoing in Arizona. The proceeds from the tour go towards providing food, tools, blankets, warm clothes, firewood, animal feed, and other necessities to elders and families that still remain on their lands. KMUD News spoke to Mark Dykin, one of the founding members of the band, to elaborate more on the issues that the Diné people face in Black Mesa and Big Mountain.
So for 34 years, we've been going to the Black Mesa, Big Mountain, Sand Springs region of the Navajo Reservation, which is north of Flagstaff. And that reservation is the largest Indian reservation in the country. And one part of it has one of the world's largest coal reserves. And that happened to be in an area where Navajo have lived traditionally for thousands of years. In 1974, the U.S. Congress passed the Navajo Hopi Relocation Act. And the reason for that was that at the time, the Hopi Tribal Council was very much more corporate friendly. And so the land was redivided to put the coal mine under the control of the Hopi Nation. That meant that over 10,000 Navajo families had to be relocated from this area. So they divided the land into three types of land. NPL, Navajo partitioned land, so Navajo people or Diné could stay there. HPL, Hopi partitioned land, which, again, Hopi never lived there, but now that land was theirs, and all the Navajo there had to leave. And then there's an area called joint use area where both could run cattle. Well, so thousands of people relocated, and that didn't work out really that well for them. But several hundred said, we're not leaving our land. And they've been there ever since. We first got involved in the early 90s to going down there to visit. And ever since, we've been bringing food, firewood, dog food, all kinds of supplies to people who, as a matter of United States government policy, here in 2025, Native Americans are still being forcibly relocated from their ancestral homelands. And these are people, traditional people. They live in eight-sided hogans, dirt floors, no electricity. They have to haul water. They don't speak English. Well, they can speak some English, but they use their traditional tongue, traditional songs, traditional prayers. And we have always felt like it was part of our duty to support those people doing what they were meant to do, stay on that land where Creator put them.
In 1974, the Navajo Hopi Settlement Act partitioned approximately 1.8 million acres of disputed land in Arizona to allegedly settle land disputes between the Navajo and Hopi tribes. The land initially was set aside in 1930 as a joint use area, JUA, to be shared by both of the tribes. The 1974 Act mandated equal division of the JUA, including the construction of a 300-mile barbed wire fence to mark the boundary. It also ordered 90% reduction of livestock herds, a moratorium on all new construction and improvements in the area, and the removal of Navajo and Hopi communities designated to be on the wrong side of the fence by 1986 to effectively gain access to the coal on the lands for strip mining. Members of the Diné tribe still remain on their land, like the Black Mesa Resistance Camp, though live without necessities like running water or electricity. Last year, Clan Daikin raised enough money to deliver 65 food units to the tribe, as well as help infrastructure and winter preparedness by donating tools and helping repair roofs. So far, this tour has been able to raise $6,683.
Part of it is, you know, just for starters, you don't have to leave the country to visit the third world. That's what we've done to Native people and to reservations everywhere, is people are living in extreme poverty. And I got to tell you, you know, we get so much more than we ever could give them just by being in their presence. And if there was ever people that should look at people and just by appearance say, stay away, we don't want anything to do with you, it would be indigenous people of Turtle Island looking at descendants of European colonizers like myself and many of our other supporters. But the opposite is true. They're always welcoming as long as we come with humility and respect. And when you look at the state of the world and who's being treated in ways that we want everyone to be treated in this country, it's harder to find any group that's been treated worse than the indigenous people of Turtle Island. And why, you know, I mentioned that about being significant to be here in this day and age. Many people think that Native people here are like some kind of history thing, and that whatever is left here has been really nicely integrated, and I can buy a nice souvenir when I drive through Flagstaff or someplace and maybe get a rug, and, you know, we're all getting along. But the reality is that Native people are still suffering incredible levels of racism, oppression, economic hardship, lack of access to things that we take for granted out here in this outside world, and that has an impact. And if we ever want to straighten things out and lift this entire nation to meet its potential, we got to take care of the original inhabitants. And that's just not being done. And so no matter where you go in this country, if you visit an Indian reservation, you're going to find out that this is a very contemporary issue, the treatment and human rights violations of the indigenous people of North America.
Music and activism have always gone hand in hand, and with Clan Daikin, it's no different. The band has been active in community service since its inception in 1986. Mark Daikin speaks more about the power of music and activism in communities.
My brother and I have been doing this since we were kids, and that's a long time. We're both in our 60s. And we've always believed that music and art in general, it's a safe space to really speak your mind and to really communicate about issues and things that matter. And when we gather, then we come together, and that's a big part of the concerts that we do. And we were taught how to do what's called a blanket dance, and that's a community round dance that helps us raise this money. But what it really does is get everyone together. It's full participation. We come off the stage, we're down on the floor, and everyone is involved in a round dance and a spiral dance. And that kind of connection, the term I like to use, is entrainment, because we are literally in training our hearts, our breathing, and we can be so focused and in the moment on what it is that we're working on that the energy that's raised is a powerful form of activism. And that's when people's hearts open. That's when they become generous with whatever it is. Maybe it's their money. Maybe it's their time. Maybe they're a farmer who has some food to give. Maybe it's someone who has access to blankets and coats. But to come together in that moment and share that kind of entrainment, I really believe that that's part of the healing that we need to do to be effective activists and to create the world we want to live in.
The show is on Sunday the 16th at the Arcata Playhouse. Doors open at 6:30 with a finger food potluck, followed by music at 7:30. There's a sliding scale donation at the door, or community members can donate supplies such as shovels or dry goods. For more information, the email is esp@asis.com. Makers of arts and lovers of culture received great news recently when the Ink People in Eureka, a backbone of the arts and culture scene in Humboldt, acquired its first permanent home since the organization was founded in 1979. Sigurd Bjorn spoke to Executive Director Leslie Castellano about this watershed moment for the arts in the county.
The Ink People is a community-based grassroots arts and culture organization that has been serving Humboldt County for decades. Through the years, the nonprofit has been housed in various different locations, making their job of supporting the artists and community organizers of Humboldt that much harder. That all changed this fall when the Ink People acquired a permanent home for the first time.
The Ink People has been around since 1979 and was founded by two local printmakers, Brenda Tuxford and Libby Maynard, along with a community of artists who were really involved or in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s.
That's the voice of Leslie Castellano, Executive Director of the Ink People. Her organization runs close to 100 programs in the county and is involved in several high-profile arts and community programs, either through funding, fundraising, or logistical support.
For much of its lifespan, the Ink People has either been in donated spaces or has been somewhat semi-itinerant or has kind of moved from space to space and has never owned a building. For many years, we were in the Eureka's Municipal Auditorium until the big earthquake that caused the staff to move out of that. And since that time, we've had to move to 4 different spaces. Most of those spaces have not been ideal in terms of allowing us to house all of our programming together and really serve as the art and culture hub that we are. And so we're limited in terms of some of the ways we could change them or renovate them to make them more accessible to the community. And so for quite a while now, we've been kind of looking for an opportunity to purchase a building, really ensuring that, one, we don't have to invest community resources into moving again and again.
But now the Ink People are vagrants no more, having just purchased a building in Old Town Eureka that will be their forever home.
We're really fortunate that there's a space right here in Old Town, which many people know as Club West. Before that, it was a department store, but it's right on 5th and G in Old Town, and it's going to be our new home.
If you are a little unclear about what exactly it is that the Ink People does, it's probably because when it comes to arts, culture, and community, the organization does just about everything.
The Ink People, as an art and culture organization, we cover a lot of territory and really connect with many different people. Our largest program is our Dreammaker program, where we serve as fiscal sponsors to more than 90 different unique art and culture projects in the community and beyond.
The Dreammaker program is made up of individual, self-directed projects created by people motivated to make their community a better place. The 90 or so Dreammaker projects span categories like performing arts, media, community engagement, and cultural heritage, to name but a few. Locals may be familiar with projects like Kids in the Hive, Humboldt Pride, and Eureka Street Art Festival.
Each of those Dreammaker projects is conducting their own unique programming, but we provide a lot of the back-end administrative support. And, you know, that's also professional development, help with grant writing, help with budgets and planning. And really, it's kind of like a business incubator almost, but for art and culture nonprofits.
Although being an umbrella for 90 Dreammaker projects is a big part of what the Ink People does, it is far from the only thing.
We also, somewhat relatedly, do some grant making where we partner with different organizations, including the county of Humboldt, to offer grants to the community. We have a youth program, the MARS program, Media Arts Resource Zone, which serves youth 12 to 24. It's a year-round free drop-in program. We have a lot of youth that stay with us for many years because we serve such a broad age range. And those youth are trained in digital media arts, new technology, and they also just have a cool place to hang out and, you know, convene and build camaraderie with other youth. The Eureka Cultural Arts District is another project that's pretty core to what we do. And that is a partnership between the Wiat Tribe, the City of Eureka, Eureka Main Street, and the Ink People, who collaborated together to secure a competitive designation by the state to be one of 14 state designated cultural arts districts. And with that, we support a wide range of art and culture programming really specific to the district in Eureka.
With its finger in so many cultural pies, it's understandably great news for the organization to finally have its own housing. But buying a house is one thing. Making it into a cultural hub is quite another.
It will take us some months of renovations to really make it what we need it to be to really serve people. We're going to be doing some renovations to finish out like a youth program area. There will be a community kind of classroom meeting space. We'll have our gallery there, as well as our administrative kind of hub will be there as well. And the space is kind of for sure larger and more expansive than where we've been in recent years. And so it will allow us to host events, you know, like pop-up art shows or poetry readings or puppet shows or art bands, or, you know, it will really depend on what the community wants to bring. For sure, some of our youth who are learning things like recording music, you know, and animation will also be hosting events there, like little pop-up youth DJ nights and things like that. I'm hoping that our gallery opens first, which will probably hopefully be sometime between February through April of 2026. And then after that, we'll bring our administrative offices over. So probably sometime between March and May. And then our youth program will keep in its current location until the school year finishes out, so we don't disrupt the youth mid their cycle. And so we'll plan to bring the youth program over in June of 2026. So over the next 5-6 months, we're going to be doing some renovation, repairs that need to be made, making it a little bit more like a gallery and a little bit less like a bar, which is what it was, you know, prior to us being there.
As Castellano points out, not only was there a bar on the northwest corner of G and Fifth, there were at least four bars there at one time or another. Names like Club West, The Alibi, Auntie Mo's, and Rosie's Billiards may evoke memories for Eurekans who may have frequented one or more of these local watering holes in the past. Castellano and her fellow inkers are excited to build a new story for the building, filled with arts, culture, community, and meaning.
And that building has, unfortunately, just to economic conditions at the time, been boarded up for a few years. And so it's really been a space without much of a story. And so one of the, I think, exciting things is just that it's a story for artists and culture keepers to come and inhabit the space, but also I think a story for the whole community in terms of how do we define ourselves as a community? How do we set out spaces that are about like meaningful human engagement? I do think that the Ink People has played a role in how we come together as a community for the last 46 years. And so I'm excited to see what we'll be able to do with other folks moving forward.
Reporting for KMUT, I'm Sigurd Bjørn.
In national news, Democrat Adelita Grijalva, finally sworn in as Congress member, promptly signs petition to release the Epstein files. KPFA's Shania Anderson reports.
Arizona Democrat Adelita Grijalva was sworn into Congress Wednesday, just over a month after winning a special election to replace her late father, Raul Grijalva. Moments after taking the oath, she signed a discharge petition that triggered a House vote on the Epstein Files Transparency Act, a bipartisan measure to release all unclassified records linked to Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking network. Grijalva's signature is a key step after 7 weeks of delay, during which House Speaker Mike Johnson refused to seat her despite her September election victory. Grijalva says the holdup was an effort to avoid this vote on the Epstein files.
But what the majority in this body has failed to do, hold Trump accountable as a co-equal branch of government that we are. It has been 50 days. Since the people of Arizona's 7th Congressional District elected me to represent them. 50 days that over 800,000 Arizonans have been left without access to the basic services that every constituent deserves. This is an abuse of power. One individual should not be able to unilaterally obstruct the swearing-in of a duly elected member of Congress for political reasons. Our democracy only works when everyone has a voice. We need to respect tribal sovereignty in our environment. We need to stand up for LGBTQ plus rights because that's what the American people expect us to do. Fight for them. That is why I will sign the discharge petition right now to release the Epstein files.
The bill, co-sponsored by California Democrat Ro Khan and Republican Thomas Massie, is backed by all Democrats and a few Republicans, including Lauren Boebert, Margine Taylor Greene, and Nancy Mace. Massie told reporters that even if a member who signed the petition leaves Congress or passes away, their signature still stands, ensuring the petition moves forward regardless. The petition comes amidst the release of 23,000 pages of documents from Epstein's estate after months of delay. Some of the emails reference President Donald Trump with messages suggesting he may have known more than he's letting on about Epstein's criminal behavior. In one 2011 email to Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein wrote, quote, "The dog that hasn't barked is Trump." One from 2018 describes Trump as, quote, "borderline insane," while another from 2019 says, quote, "of course he knew about the girls." Trump has dismissed the new disclosures as, quote, "a Democrat hoax," and warned his Republican supporters to not fall into that trap, blaming Democrats for trying to smear him. White House Secretary Karoline Leavitt echoed that view, saying the emails, quote, "prove nothing," and dismissing the uproar as a distraction engineered by Democrats, timed just as Trump was preparing to end the government shutdown.
These emails prove absolutely nothing other than the fact that President Trump did nothing wrong. And what President Trump has always said is that he was from Palm Beach and so was Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein was a member at Mar-a-Lago until President Trump kicked him out because Jeffrey Epstein was a pedophile and he was a creep.
With Representative Grijalda sworn in and having signed the petition, the countdown is officially on for a full House vote that could finally release the long-awaited Epstein files in their entirety. That vote is expected to come in early December. For KPFA News, I'm Shania Anderson.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new study aims to shed light on the hidden impacts of domestic violence in Native communities. The Mountain West News Bureau's Daniel Spalding reports on the effort to understand the unrecognized brain injuries many survivors are living with.
The Urban Indian Health Institute survey aims to find out how common traumatic brain injuries are among Native survivors of domestic and sexual violence. More than 80% of Indigenous women have experienced violence in their lifetime. According to Abigail Echohawk, the Institute's director, many survivors of domestic and sexual violence suffer from brain injuries that never get diagnosed or receive proper care.
They deserve justice, they deserve safety, and they deserve to get the treatment that they need when they've been impacted by traumatic brain injury.
The goal of the survey is to ensure survivors get the right care and support through programs and policies designed to help them heal. The survey began in October and will remain open through January 2026. I'm Daniel Spalding.
A nonprofit has released a new UPIC glossary with behavioral health terms. UPIC speakers, including those affected by the recent Western Alaska storm, which devastated communities, can use it to communicate with their health providers and to understand their mental health better. Ayulna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Last month, Moses Mahak Wiseman was helping with UPIC translation at the Anchorage shelters that hosted evacuees from the recent Western Alaska storm. He was also sharing a new glossary with UPIC words for behavioral health terms.
When you have a culture of your own that's not a part of American culture, it's a taboo thing to talk about behavioral health and mental health care. So like having this available when it was available, it's just an ease of mind, I think.
Wiseman is the Alaska Native Languages Program Director at the Alaska Institute for Justice. Last month, the nonprofit released a new glossary. People can type in a modern health-related term,
self-stigma,
and listen to its UPIC pronunciation.
Shminik gazmukluni.
Wiseman says it should help UPIC interpreters and service providers to break down language barriers and help people understand their health better. Indra Arriaga is the strategic and operational director at the Institute for Justice.
Where you do have a stigma around depression, a stigma around suicide. This is a way of getting information and not feeling like you're exposing yourself, right? It's out there, it's reliable, it's in your language, it's a door.
Arriaga says the glossary has been years in the making in collaboration with UPIC speakers. The plan was to launch the project on November 1st, but when the remnants of the Typhoon Halong forced hundreds of people to evacuate to Anchorage, the organization decided to release it sooner.
The care and the healing of the folks who are here from Kipnuk and other villages is going to continue. So this is a resource that now can really be used in settings where they're going to be talking about different things that affect their mental health.
The organization is now looking for funding to complete a similar glossary, but for terms relevant for emergency care and intake. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
The National Congress of American Indian says it welcomes the reopening of the federal government to restore stability to critical services to tribes. In a statement, NCAI said during the shutdown, the Indian Health Service largely remained open due to advance appropriations, but it's depending on Congress to extend Affordable Care Act tax credits, and that reopening the government restores funding to food assistance programs that many Native people rely on. The organization says temporary fixes are not enough and that data collected from tribes during the shutdown made clear how long-term lasting solutions and structural funding reforms are needed to honor tribal trust and treaty obligations. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler, and thanks to our reporters, Gabriel Zucker, Sigurd Bjorn, Shania Anderson, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.